You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. The deportation bus. Yes, there's a deportation bus, a candidate for governor down in Georgia. Evidently, State Senator Michael Williams. His gimmick is they're going to go around to those evil sanctuary cities and round them up and take them out with the deportation bus. The only problem is deportation bus broke down on the first leg of the tour. Yeah, there you go. The bus took a breakdown. I guess they got it fixed back on the tour. And you go, yeah, again, more of what you need. Now they're claiming. The claim is it was Antifa who put water in their gas tank. I don't know about that. But, hey, you know, they say we're gonna keep an eye on the bus or the deportation bus much, much closer. So there you go. A way to start the day off with a broken down bus. Much like our economy for the vast majority of folks. In fact, a new United Way ALICE Project report came out, and ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. That means you're broke. They find that nearly 51 million households across this great nation with an economy that's booming, unemployment never lower, according to the Donald, evidently can't afford to pay the monthly bills. Basic housing, basic food, childcare, healthcare, transportation. And now a cell phone is part of that. And look, in this day and age, you can't get along without a cell phone. That's the study was released today by the United Way's ALICE Project. That's 43% of all households. 51 million people in households in this country. That figure includes what they're saying, 16.1 million households who are now living in poverty, as well as the 34.7 million families that are making just less than what's needed to, quote, survive in the modern economy. Now, what they say is, look, you know, despite all of these wonderful signs, the economy's growing, it's great, it's beautiful, there are still families that are facing financial hardships. And as I read this, you know, there's a way we fix this stuff. There's a way. We have a massive inequality problem in this country, and what's happening, and it's happening right before our very eyes, is the wealth class of this country has figured out that the best way to gain more for themselves is by dividing us. And as you know, and I've been very, very upfront and very straightforward with my support of labor unions and the right of workers to bargain collectively and fight for better wages, hours, conditions, all of that. I've never hidden that fact from anyone because I believe that equal partners sitting down at a table and bargaining for conditions on the job, who's going to share in what wealth, what benefits are going to be. That's the best scenario. Not having government dictate, not having the employer as the master of the domain, but having partnerships and equality. And also, you know, having the CEO who's making, you know, $12, $20, $100 million a year sitting down across the table from a worker representative and saying, hey, look, you're making $100 million a year. Our folks need a little bit too. You know, back when union density was at its height, 1965, 35% union density in this country, inequality was much less. In fact, the CEO of companies made 20 times what the average worker was making back then. That number has skyrocketed to 300 times. And that's because, well, in the private sector, you got about 6.4% union density. But yet, you still hear, and I get this all the time, and this is where, you know, you have to give the moneyed interests credit. Understand, the Koch brothers and the Walton Foundation and all of these very wealthy think tanks and all of these billionaires, they're not going to spend money pushing an idea that's going to benefit you. And I don't... You know, I guess it's one of those things that, you know, my grandfather had a saying for it. He'd always say, you know, if a rich guy is going to take a buck out of his pocket and tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. And if he were alive today, he would look at the massive amounts of money that the Koch brothers and the Waltons and the billionaire class are spending on telling us how bad unions are. And he would say, you know what? You better go get them, because nothing good comes when they get what they want. And, you know, as I was reading some of the, there's a bunch of stuff out there. There's another one of these grand plans that the State Policy Network has put out on how they're going to go and destroy unions. And we've talked about this, over the last several months of, you know, how there's going to be a massive, decertification campaign where they're going to hire people to go out and knock on members' doors and say, hey, you know, you can get a rebate from your union. Here, all you have to do is sign this card. And what they're actually signing is a decertification card. And all kinds of stuff. And there's going to be tons of shenanigans and tons of nonsense coming. Union members, you're going to have to wake up and become very, very, very militant. And the hope is look, I mean, there's a hope that the labor movement becomes much more militant again. There's a hope that, you know, the Koch brothers and their ilk have gone too far. And that eventually we come back to that realization of my grandparents' generation, that if the rich guy is going to take a buck out of his pocket, we better, whatever he's advocating, we better go get the opposite. Because here's the interesting thing. One of the statistics that came out of this United Way study is that almost two-thirds of all the jobs in this country pay less than $20 an hour. I mean, stop and think about that for a second. Almost two-thirds of all the jobs pay less than $20 an hour. So when you float the idea of a $15 an hour minimum wage, you've got all of these people, probably half the country, who barely make $15 an hour, saying, no, well, what about me? Without realizing that eventually everyone gets bumped up. But we've been so concentrated in this, you know, what, mine, me, that we don't think about the big picture in this. And what was interesting is, you look at these numbers, and it's mind-blowing that what's happened in this country is we're the wealthiest country in the world, and the wealthiest country in the history of civilization and all that, and that's undisputed. We have more wealth in this country than at any time in the history of this country. And yet it's all been consolidated into the hands of, some say the 1%, some say the 1% of 1%. I argue, you know, about 10% of the people control the vast majority of wealth in this country. I mean, like 90% of it, when you really stop and think about it. Most of us are in some form of debt or another. In fact, I saw something the other day that said that the average credit card debt among working people was something like $12,000. And I'm going, my goodness. I mean, you talk about company store. You talk about company script, right there, in debt to the company. Granted, this it's Visa or MasterCard or whoever, but that's still like being in debt to the company that you work for, because you can't quit. You're not going anywhere. And they know this. And the thing that gets me is, you look at this last tax bill. What we did is we made inequality worse with this tax bill. In the past, you could argue our tax bill made things a little bit more our tax law made things a little more equal. If you made over $1.6 million, for instance, back during, in today's dollars, back during the Eisenhower years, a good, you know, socialist president, you paid 92% tax on that dollar over $1.6 million. So this incentive for insatiable greed, for, you know, outrageous greed, wasn't there because you said, well, you know what, use it how we need to get things done, you know, and you know, put your name on buildings, build libraries, whatever, or we're going to take it and we're going to use it. And understand, nobody paid the 92%, just so you don't get all freaked out. But they did pay considerably higher, which is how we invested in roads and bridges and built a highway system, and how we had an education system that was fully funded and, you know, had extracurricular time and, you know, all kinds of stuff, and which is how people would go to college and not end up with a lifetime of debt when they got out and all of that stuff. But you look at this mass inequality, and there are far too many families that are struggling to make ends meet. And every one of us knows somebody who's struggling. And we've been trained in our mind, it's just, you got to work harder. You got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You know, just buckle down and work harder. When the reality is, you know, the wages that we earn have been stagnant for 40 years. You know, I tell this story all the time. When I started working back in the late 80s, I worked on a shipping dock making $15 an hour as a casual. Once you got onto the list, the top rate was like 18 and high change, like 1870, 1880. You got full health care, you got pension, you got paid sick days, you got, you know, vacation, you got all of these things back then. We're talking, you know, not economic gimmickry, no calculators or anything figuring out for today's dollars or anything. It was that's what the numbers were back then. And today, doing that exact job, if I were to start out today doing that exact job, it's $14 an hour, no benefits, no health care, no pension, no matter how many hours I work, no vacation, no sick days. You get on the list, you get hired full time. It goes up to $18 an hour after a couple of years. So, you know, even if you say, look, you know, 14 is less than 15, 18 is less than almost 19, 30 years of deflation, 30 years of stagnation. And that has everything to do with the fact that the unions have been broken in this country. And we're on the verge of it being them being completely broken here. Because the Koch brothers and their ilk have spent so much money, so much resource, so much time, so much energy attacking. And also in members' ears. Because, you know, just seconds before I came on air, you know, someone tweeted at me going, you know, my husband works in a union shop and he says, and here come the talking points, the union only protects the lazy people. And how many times have you heard that? I mean, thousands of times. And I say, well, the reality is if there are lazy people there, the company is, it's malpractice on their part for not to get rid of them. Because every union has a pathway, a due process to get rid of people who are not doing their job. And if the company chooses not to do that, that's not the union's fault. That's the company's fault. And the other part of it is generally the people who are pointing their finger saying that everybody else is lazy, generally that person's the lazy one. And it's interesting to me because I get this from people who, you know, they justify all kinds of things. They justify their behavior based on what others are doing. And at the end of the day, understand, we are stronger together than we are divided. The company gave you nothing. Everything that we have, the 40-hour work week, the 8-hour day, vacations, healthcare, all of that stuff, somebody fought, bled, and died for. At some point, someone stood up and said, we demand these things. And they put their family in peril to get them. And to have people in a very flippant kind of way say, well, you know, that doesn't matter, kind of infuriating. Anyway, I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Are you one of the 51 million families across this country struggling to make ends meet? I'd love to hear your stories. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back with Scott Paul. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. We're going to find out about the ZTE bailout, the tariffs, China, so much more. Quick break, right back.
Take a look at yourself. 1% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day 4,000 strikers and their supporters gathered for the March for Dignity and Respect in Laurel, Mississippi. Over 200 mostly black women members of the International Chemical Workers Union, Local 882, had been on strike against Sanderson Farms' chicken processing plant for 15 months. Trade unionists from as far away as Cincinnati, Memphis, and North Carolina came to march in support. Sanderson Farms had cleared $58 million in profit, but paid workers just $3 an hour. The women demanded a contract that included more control over assembly line speed, overtime pay, and insurance. They complained of desperately low wages, inhumane working conditions, and even the inability to use the bathroom when necessary. Workers were given only gloves and an apron once a month, and a file to sharpen their often dull and rusty scissors and knives. They often referred to the processing plant as the plantation, where sexual harassment was rampant. Women workers often found themselves given dangerous assignments or even fired if they didn't put up with sexual advances of their foreman. Workers maintained that strikebreakers from the community were desperately poor and threatened with violence if they quit by local Ku Klux Klansmen who worked as supervisors at the plant. Some were known to have been involved in the murder and/or intimidation of civil rights workers in decades past. The plant had been organized in 1972, but was extraordinarily weak. Nonetheless, women strikers understood that the union still served as an invaluable resource in the midst of a largely unorganized South. By the following February, the NLRB ruled that Sanderson had to resume contract negotiations and allow strikers to return to their jobs.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
We're talking about the time of growth. Time of growth.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So I've been asking the question, where are all of the Tea Party types? Where are the Oath Keepers? Where are the minions? Where are the Trump faithful? Where are all those people who, when Obama bailed out or sort of bailed out the auto industry, were screaming at the top of their lungs? Where are they now when we look at what's going on with ZTE and the bailout that, you know, look, that's the only word I can use. We're bailing them out. Because they got themselves into a whole lot of trouble. And this administration is the one who said we're going to enforce that. And I guess now not so much. Here to talk about what's going on with China, with trade, with NAFTA, with tariffs, all of that, our resident expert, Scott Paul. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, always. Anything for you, sir.
Lots of stuff to get cleared up. First, let's talk about the ZTE bailout. I'm looking at this going, this is important national security kind of stuff. If we don't enforce what we say, what's the point in saying it?
Yeah, and this coming from a president who talked about American jobs, America first, just railed on China always, you know, said, you know, if you look up his phrase, like China is laughing at us, you know, you'll get about 1,000 hits because he says that all the time. And then, you know, on Twitter, makes this pronouncement that ZTE, which is a, just so everybody knows, is a Chinese telecommunications company. It has a lot of relationships with the Chinese government in Beijing. It has been barred from doing business in the United States because there are serious national security concerns. For instance, the military didn't allow ZTE telecommunications products to be sold to the military because of the risk of spyware having been inserted, so that essentially the government of China could be spying on the U.S. military. And this is a company that not once but twice has broken our sanctions law and has been found to have been selling products into Iran and into North Korea in violation of sanctions. So, you know, it's the unified consensus of our national security community. And by judging by the congressional response, an overwhelming number of Democrats and Republicans, that ZTE shouldn't be doing business in the United States. Yet here you have a president who says, you know, there's lots of lost jobs in China, not America, China, and that, you know, maybe there's a way to help out ZTE. It is it's an alarming tweet. I think it's very dangerous, and I'm very concerned about it. And my hope is that this is just kind of bluster and he'll, you know, that'll move on to something else without doing anything for ZTE. But it's something that, unfortunately, we have to take seriously.
Yeah, and he's going to get it done fast. We're going to just cool it. We're going to get it done fast. And I go, you know, okay, but here's the thing. There are national security implications, and I think those are extremely important and things we should be talking about on not just telecommunications, but virtually everything our military needs. But, you know, I've been hammered with the well, you know, Rick, we're going to lose a lot of American jobs because of it, because, you know, they buy a lot of our stuff. And, you know, that argument, I don't know that holds a lot of water with me.
Yeah. So, look, it is true that there are some U.S. products that went into a ZTE phone. Qualcomm, for instance, sold some chips to ZTE, but that's not their only market. That's not to say there won't be a transition. But, you know, saving some American jobs and putting ZTE back into business in the United States, again, I just point back to our military leaders who say this would be very dangerous. It would be a threat to our national security. And it's a threat that we should take seriously. And so everybody from Chuck Schumer to Marco Rubio has been expressing grave concerns about the president's response here. And in part, Rick, it's because it's so out of the blue. I mean, where did this come from? It just flies in the face of everything that we were led to believe about the president and his policies. And so it raises, obviously, a lot of really, really serious questions about the motivation here as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complete about face. And you go, where did it come from? But for me, the bigger picture, and, you know, I had someone who, you know, tweeted at me saying, well, Rick, you're not getting the big picture. And I'm going, no, I get the big picture. And the big picture is China wants to dominate the world with technology. Their China Made 2025 plan is all about taking over technology and taking over the innovation of a number of industries. And, you know, to me, this has got to be part of that big picture talk where, yeah, maybe we're going to have some problems short term. But the big picture is they want to do what they've done to a lot of our industries, you know, aluminum, steel, other ones being part of that. And that's completely dominate them and not play fair in the international market.
Yeah, the stakes here with respect to ZTE are really significant. I don't pretend like I'm an expert on broadband or telecommunications, but 5G is going to be the next next frontier in broadband, you know, higher speeds, better resolution, all of that, more capabilities. And ZTE is one of the companies leading the charge on that and to do 5G in such a way that the Chinese government is more or less writing the rules of what this new cellular system should look like. I am not a xenophobe, but I will say I do think that while we should always seek common ground with our brothers and sisters in China, and I harbor no fears about Chinese culture, most types of Chinese ideas that are coming from the people. I don't like the authoritarian government, obviously. I that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be wary about some of these security concerns, whether we're progressives, conservatives, you know, moderates, anything, because, you know, this is both about writing the rules of the future And America should have a part in that, as well as making sure that we're literally not giving the Chinese government tools to spy on our military without even trying. I mean, you know they do, right? And you know they want to because that's a game that big powers all play. But you don't want to give them the keys to the car and say, here, you're going to be able to find out everything about what's happening on our military bases with our citizen population. To me, that's just I'm enough of an economic nationalist, a progressive one, but to say you got to draw the line somewhere, and ZT is on the other side of that line.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this is where, you know, I had read something the other day that said, you know, since 2004, the United States has not lost a trade case in front of the WTO. We haven't lost any of the trade cases with China, and yet we still continue to lose. I mean, we win the cases, but the industries are still gone. The harm is done. The jobs are lost. The economic prosperity for this country gone. But they keep losing. We keep winning, but we end up with the short end of the winning stick, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the way you put it because it's an interesting statistic, and it is, you know, it's quite misleading. Because it is true to say that when we've been bringing cases against WTO, we've been winning them. But then the question you have to ask is like, well, what have the results been? And when you look at the results, China will pop up a trade barrier or a tax incentive or a subsidy somewhere else, even though they may have just torn the one down that the WTO said they had to tear down. And it's like playing a game of whack-a-mole. And you can't do that all the time. It can be incredibly frustrating to do that. And so we keep having the same expectation that if we take a WTO case and we win it, China will change its behavior and we'll see a measurable difference in our trade relationship. That hadn't happened. And so anybody who expects the same thing is probably smoking something because, you know, there's nothing that indicates to me that China is going to change its behavior pattern in response to Donald Trump unless there is a different approach. And that doesn't mean necessarily giving up on the WTO altogether. We have serious flaws with it, but we shouldn't count on the WTO to be looking out for the interests of American workers. We have to do a lot of that ourselves. Right. And it involves the Congress. It involves the president. It involves a very sophisticated approach, but going the WTO route alone just doesn't make sense because you can't demonstrate anywhere, that even though we've won some of these cases, that we've seen a measurable difference in the imbalances that we've seen with China, in the unfair trade practices that they have erected. And as you indicated, Rick, it's especially concerning as we look ahead. Because it's not only steel and aluminum, it's also semiconductors, artificial intelligence, robotics, advanced batteries, autonomous vehicles, aerospace platforms, biotechnology, a lot of the industries that we look at being 21st century industries as well. And that's, you know, we can't afford to just literally give those industries away.
No, I'm right there with you. And you basically named all of the industries their China Made 2025 plan is going to go after. And,
that's,
you know,
right.
For me, when I look at this, you know, they have a vision of where they want their entire economy to go. So they're, you know, they're giving, you know, cheap loans and deregulating, and they're, you know, doing all kind of mercantilist kind of things to where we're kind of okay, you know, whatever. There doesn't seem to be a major plan. And they're really eating our lunch. I mean, and this is where I think people are, where Trump, you know, the blind squirrel found a nut in this. He's right. China cheats. I'm still waiting for them to label them as currency manipulators. There's a lot we should and can be doing. And this thing with ZTE is just completely, completely the wrong way, in my view, and sends the wrong messages because you're going to say, we're going to get tough. And then, well, we're not.
Right. Well, we're going to get tough, and then the first negotiating tactic right out of the box is to make an enormous concession to China without getting anything whatsoever in return. And it's a concession that would have far-reaching national security implications in a negative way for the United States. That's not the art of any sort of deal. It's not the art of war. it, in a lot of ways, it's the art of stupidity. And it is not a great way to negotiate. So I'm, you know, I think that we have to up our game. I know Bob Lighthizer, the trade ambassador, Wilbur Ross. I mean, these are very smart guys who do international negotiations all the time. I think that, you know, if you gave them an outline of marching orders, let them do their jobs, that they could do it quite well. But, you know, when you have the president tweeting out stuff like ZTE, you know, that does more than gets in the way. It probably makes China question the kind of resolve that we have to really push back.
Yeah, a good point. Let me ask you real quick, you know, the tariffs on steel and aluminum. You know, people are losing their mind over this. And again, to me, it's one of those vital industries that we have to protect on a certain level because, you know, just from a national security standpoint, we absolutely need it. But as a country, you need a productive process. Where are we? Are they going to go into effect? Are we going to give like this? Are we going to give massive waivers? Is it going to be toothless? What are you expecting at this point, given what we see?
Yeah, Rick, I'm so hopeful. So we've seen some of the tariffs have taken effect on the countries that aren't exempt from them. But there are, and those are 25% tariffs on steel, 10% on aluminum. We've made an alternate arrangement with a few countries. South Korea is one that's agreed to a quota on steel that actually will reduce the volume of imports coming in from South Korea. There's some indication that we have deals in the works with Australia, Argentina, Brazil. Where we haven't quite made a deal yet is with Mexico and Canada. That is wrapped up in the NAFTA negotiations with the European Union. And those are both large kind of steel importing markets into the United States. But I will say that despite a lot of really noticeable missteps by the president, the way this was rolled out was terrible. The fact that he talked tough for months and then did nothing had an impact on the industry. Despite all of that, I think it's fair to say we've seen some progress in steel and aluminum. And if anything, it's shown that, yeah, we can kind of claw some of these steel jobs back. And you've seen a blast furnace reopen in Granite City, Illinois. You've seen a Republic Engineering opening a line of steel products in Lorain, Ohio. You've seen a British company invest in a shuttered steel mill in Georgetown, South Carolina. You've seen a steel pipe maker down in Houston, Texas. This is going to be both melting its own steel and then transforming it into pipe down in Houston. On the flip side, while there's a lot of complaints about from steel consumers about prices and what have you, the data, at least so far, is showing, yes, there have been some increased prices, but from an employment perspective, from an output perspective, these industries are doing quite well. And they've been doing quite well for a couple of months, and the tariffs have not had a material impact on that. And moving forward, there's some question as to you know, how big or small that impact is going to be. So I'm hopeful about this. But it's a, you know, the president can't back off, and that would be a disaster to the steel industry. He's got to stay tough on this, and can't afford any backsliding, because all of those steel jobs that have been established, you know, they'd be a risk if you see imports surge into the market again.
Yeah, someone take his Twitter account away quickly. I did want to get into real quick, since you brought up Mexico. Any updates on the negotiations? I know we're coming to the end of the possibility of anything happening because of the elections in Mexico and all that. Any words where we're what we might see, if anything?
Yeah, so I think they may be getting close to a deal on renegotiation. You know, I will say the administration and labor leaders will tell you this. They've reached out more to labor than the Obama administration did on a trade perspective, and have solicited the advice of labor union leaders and workers on this. What's going to happen, I'm not sure. I mean, Paul Ryan set this artificial deadline, which made me chuckle, Rick, because when's the last time Paul Ryan met a deadline on on funding? And then, oh, we have to have enough time to examine this. I mean, how many bills have they passed that are hundreds of pages long and where they've kept them secret and then passed them within 48 hours? I mean, you're probably right now just thinking in your head all the times that they've done this, which has been dozens upon dozens of times. You know, if this deadline slides by a couple weeks or even a month, I'm not worried. I think that they can still do it in this Congress. But at the end of the day, I'm going to look at it and just like everybody in the labor movement, is it better for American workers? Does it make sure that Mexican workers aren't exploited and that we're pitting our workers against each other? Because that would be bad. And are there mechanisms in place to reduce the trade deficit we have, in particular with Mexico on automobiles? But there's a lot of other issues that we can unpack in NAFTA, but I think fundamentally, those are the things that need to change the most. And my test is going to be how well does this agreement, not the promises, not the tweets, how well does this agreement move us forward? And do we need 100% of that? Do we need 80% of this? I don't think half a loaf is going to work, but I do think that we need to make substantial progress.
I'm with you. The only deadline I care about Paul Ryan meeting right now is his retirement deadline to see him on down on the road. Last question I've got for you. There was a story this week, I'm sure you've seen it, that the Chinese are investing in a theme park project in Indonesia, $500 million. There's going to be a couple of Trump hotels, some golf courses, a residence, and I'm not sure if it's his or for him. Any thoughts on, you know, does this not look right? Does this look like possible quid pro quo? What, any thoughts?
It looks terrible. I mean, you know, there is a, you know, there, you know, some Trump tweet on ZTE out of the blue. I mean, just completely out of the blue. That was nothing that had been on the table before. And then this news of major Chinese investment. I mean, I am not an expert on emoluments or anything like that. I don't pretend to be. I don't know how that is defensible in any way. I really struggle with that. And, you know, keep in mind, this is a president who's never been afraid of being hypocritical, whether it's where he sources his own products or his own steel for his construction projects or anything like that. And so is it surprising? No, it's probably not surprising, right, given who we're dealing with. But it is deeply upsetting. And to even bring up the possibility that this could be impacting serious trade negotiations that impact millions of workers in America in some way is really troubling.
Yeah, what I like to remind people, we impeached a president on a land deal that the president lost money on.
Yeah, right.
Kind of want to throw that out there. Scott, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Always great to be with you.
Thanks for sharing your expertise. And look, we're in interesting times with this president. And I got to tell you, the about face does not give me a whole lot of warm, fuzzy feeling that he's going to move us forward on the trade issue. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. This is why we fight, why we lie awake. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day the U.S. Supreme Court handed down their decision in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. In the unanimous decision, the court declared that racial segregation in public education was illegal. The case was filed for Linda Brown, a student who had been denied enrollment in her local elementary school because she was black. The court's decision overturned the concept of separate but equal. This legal basis
basis for discrimination and segregation had been established by the Supreme Court earlier in their 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision. The Brown decision overturned nearly six decades of legally sanctioned racism. The American Federation of Teachers filed an amicus brief, or friend of the court brief, in support of the Brown family. The union's motion stated, quote, "The American Federation of Teachers, whose 60,000 classroom teacher members represent the group which does the actual work of teaching the nation's children, is committed to a practice of complete equality between teachers and children of every race. This principle is written indelibly in its constitution and bylaws." In addition, the United Federation of Teachers of New York City also filed a brief with the court in support of Brown. Even after the court's decision, school desegregation did not come easy. Mobs of angry white Southerners showed up at schools to protest the admission of black students. In 1957, the National Guard had to protect nine black students attempting to enroll in school in Little Rock, Arkansas. The United Teachers Union led the American Federation of Teachers to expel Southern Union locals that refused to abide by the desegregation decision. The Brown decision helped to launch the civil rights movement. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. A new Survey Monkey tracking poll. Yes, it's the Survey Monkey. Just 13%. 13% of Americans say they considered Donald J. Trump to be honest and trustworthy. 13%. I think that convicted felons are higher on the trust and trustworthiness list than our president. And congratulations. Here's the thing. Just in the last year, since February 2017, he's only dropped 3 points. 3 points. So I guess there's still a little ways to go. I mean, I wonder what you'd have to do to get the other 13 to go, you know what? No, I don't really trust him. I wonder what it would be. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world in Washington, D.C. Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. I might beat that 13%. You never know.
See, I think, you know? Yeah, I think, look, I'm going, wow, 13%, that's, I mean, yeah, that's almost in pro-herpes range.
Yeah, right. So,
I mean, it's just absolutely scary stuff. But, I mean, you know, the sad reality is you look at what's coming out of this White House. How can you trust a word? I mean, mind-blowing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get into it. The Senate Judiciary Committee has released more than 2,500 documents of the Tower meeting. What did we learn? Anything?
Well, you know, I questioned the release. I mean, what was the complete motivation behind it? But you know, some of it was repetition. I think the committee wants to, quote, do its work. Senator Burr, you know, has been doing this for about a year, I think. But there were three parts that were basically, I mean, there were some more, don't get me wrong, Rick, but there were three basic parts that was some additional new information. And I think that probably is not news, I assume, to Mueller, but it certainly was news to, you know, at least to the media about the meetings, a little bit more detail, who asked for what, who did what. So it's yet to be seen where all of this gels together. It's a little bit confusing for the public, too, because there are two separate avenues here. One is Russia, and what did it do in the elections? And the second focuses, of course, on the Trump campaign and what they did and what they knew and who they talked to.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me. You know, you've been going this whole time that this investigation's been going on, and Trump's been saying, you know, no collusion, no collusion, no collusion. And now you've got Rudy running around going, well, collusion's not really a crime. Yeah, you know, maybe they did talk to the Russians. Yeah, maybe. Because I remember Trump saying, you know, we never talked to them. I never had any dealings with the Russians. Never anything. Nothing. And now they're not just walking that back. They're running that back.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. And, And look, Rudy Giuliani is continuing in the media. And as I, you know, been asked to analyze this freak on some stations today, where they said, well, you know, his legal knowledge, that is not why he is working for the White House. It has nothing to do with legal knowledge. He is out there for one reason, to
change
be a junkyard dog.
He's changing the story. And,
right. To get out there, be the junkyard dog, be the pit bull, get out there, you know, take it on, quote, put Mueller in a corner in the court of public opinion and do that. Because, you know, he is a face people know, right? Yep. And so that's why he's out there. And it's not by accident that he's doing it. It's like the indictment thing. Well, you know, if you go back to the shows you and I have done, I think we both knew a long time ago that most likely Mueller cannot indict. Now, Mueller can say, here's what happened, and I would indict if I could, but he may have some legal constraints or might have to go through the court system, which could take 4, 5, or 6 years, yep. Right? So, you know, that wasn't a new revelation, but the way he said it, he said Mueller has come to terms with the fact, you know.
Yeah,
so this is all Rudy.
Of course. And look, and I've been saying along, and we've been having these conversations as Rudy's been doing this media tour. You know, a lot of people are saying, you know, he's a doofus and he doesn't know what he's doing. And I came out from the start and said, look, he knows exactly what he's doing. He's muddy in the waters. He's changing the story. He's changing the conversation. And look, you know, the fact that we're even talking about, oh, well, you know, Mueller's team told me we can't indict. We'd said that a long time ago.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean,
it's
amazing to me. And, you know, and again, now we're going to start with another boogeyman, I guess. First, it was that, you know, the Obama administration had tapped their phones, which Carter Page, I got to be honest, should have been tapped. And a bunch of those people who have had longtime Russian ties. Now, evidently, Obama had a plant in the campaign. Is that accurate?
Well, no, I think they're more or less saying the FBI had an informant. Oh. Is what I read.
Okay.
Giuliani is trying to argue.
They had a plant in the campaign. I mean, when I say Obama, I mean Obama's FBI, because Obama was the president at the time. The FBI
right. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay.
Because the way it was framed to me, I got a couple of emails going, see, Obama was not only spying on their phones, you know, he had a spy in their campaign. And I'm going, that's not accurate.
No, because as I understood it, it was the FBI potentially had an informant. And then it's yet to be seen what the informant, you know, was there for. And that's when Giuliani came out and said that if this is accurate, then, you know, basically Comey should be prosecuted. Well, there is a fine line in the Justice Department, how well I know, where they interfere with elections. And that can happen. But let's face it, if you want to talk about interference with elections, if they did have, you know, a mole in the campaign for some reason, not to get information on the campaign, but to get information of something that was going down or the Russians or whatever. Let's face it, as far as interference in the election, Comey's timing with Hillary Clinton. So if anything, Comey was a bipartisan interferer.
Yeah, everyone hated
Comey. If we
want
to look at that. Right. Everybody did.
At one point or another, everyone's either loved him or hated him at one point or another.
Exactly.
Depending on where in the horse race you found yourself. And I got to be honest, I was reading through one of the articles on why the FBI hadn't moved sooner on the collusion angle with the Trump campaign. And it was all because I think everybody had it in the bag that Hillary was going to win and that, you know, eventually they'd mop up and they didn't want to really get involved in it.
Uh-huh.
And here we are. Hillary didn't win. And the guy who was cheating all along quite possibly could be the guy who's in the White House.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't know who the informant was. It's redacted material, but, you know, they're just saying that. And again, Giuliani says, if Comey authorized that. You don't know when there's these informants and CIA agents. I was around the Congress, Rick, long enough to know. There's a lot of rogue activity, you know, that has nothing that is sanctioned by some of these agencies.
Right.
It's just rogue activity.
And this is where, you know, everyone goes, oh, deep state. You know, it's the deep state. They're out to get Donald Trump. All these rogue people are out to get Donald Trump. And I'm going, you know, I don't know that I'm buying all of that.
Well, you know, like I said, it could happen all over the place. And if we want to talk about interference in elections, Comey did interfere in the Clinton election. And actually, because somebody said, well, you know, as far as how he cleared her, well, it may end up, and I don't know what Mueller's going to do, who knows, but he may not clear the president. He may say, I would have indicted, or here's what happened. But Comey, after all, if he believed there was not enough to charge Hillary Clinton, he should never have cleared her the way he did, which was to clear her and then trash her. Now Mueller would be different because he had an investigatory end to this, and it would be a different scenario for him of what he says at the end, because it's a different investigation.
Now, Mueller is going to indict a whole bunch more people, I do believe.
Oh, absolutely.
Tons of people. He may not get to Trump, but if I'm Jared, I'm worrying. If I'm Junior, I'm worrying. If I'm the other idiot son, I'm worrying. All down the line, I'm worrying. And a lot of this stuff, again, comes back to congressional action then. What do they do once all this stuff is on the table?
Well, I don't think that there is going to be much done. Now, if the House goes to the Democratic side, that may be different, but honestly, it may not, too. Depends on how many votes, what's the outcome going to be. You don't want to go after something that you can't absolutely, you know, get to the finish line. So it's yet to be seen.
Yeah. Let's move on. The ZTE bailout. Any thoughts on us saving a bunch of Chinese jobs at the expense of what I would argue is our national security?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen in the end. You know, Trump was in the art of the deal, the Chinese company. And now the director of the FBI, who serves under the president, Ray, has come out and said, you know, we can't trust this company. And they did put sanctions on them for 7 years. So I really just don't see where the company is going to be able to, you know, get these benefits and have it get through the system. I don't see where it's going to happen. I understand president wants to do the trade differential, and he wants to get them to buy products, but you got to watch what you're trading. And the Chinese are very manipulative and, you know, pretty sly about things. I mean, I think they threw that out there not thinking they would even get a response.
Yeah.
No?
No, I agree. And, you know, for someone who was the Mr. Art of the Deal, watching him, you know, with these negotiations, I don't know. I'm seriously questioning that title. And I'm also questioning the title on with what's going on with North Korea. It looks like North Korea's got the upper hand here. And we're looking like the teenage girl who's, you know, waiting for that second phone call.
Well, yeah, what I think happened here is a couple of things. You know, one, Kim Jong-un being Kim Jong-un. Number two, we have no communication with this country whatsoever, basically. And it's just like Iran. If something happens and the Iranians say something and we say something, you know, it's almost on the brink of war. With Israel and America, for example, when Netanyahu and Obama, you know, who didn't, it's, you know, in fact, they didn't spectacularly get along. And when they would maybe jab at each other, the two countries didn't get a divorce, right? Well, in this case, you know, it's a hermit kingdom. So anything said, we react a certain way, although Trump acted very laissez-faire about it, you know, of what he would do. Number two, and I argued this, and I know you know who my favorite person is as a punching bag politically, John Bolton, National Service Agency, you know, NSA director, and I suspicioned this, and it actually came out in print today, so I was correct. John Bolton has made two statements on North Korea that could almost sabotage the entire deal because he doesn't want it, and the chief of staff, Kelly, is on the other side of this. He wants this deal to go through. And so Kim Jong-un understands there's a division in the White House, shock, shock, and he's utilizing that to throw a few wrenches in the works to see what he can get.
Yeah. No, as I said right from the beginning, I fear their con man is much smarter than our con man. That's always been my fear. And let's wrap up with the EU. Evidently, the EU saying, hey, stop threatening us. What's this about?
Right. Oh, look, when it comes to China, you know, China is sort of like the baby that whines and cries and it's not treated fair. And we all know that, you know, it's got the giant rattle. You know, it's the one that's manipulated everybody. It's planned on taking our jobs, inferior products here. We know the story. Now, the European Union is a bit different. They really are not hostile to us. It's Europe. It's not the, you know, communist China. So they're not hostile to us. And I think what they're saying is, whoa, you know, we're willing to talk about this. Let's not, you know, take the hammer over us like you they didn't say like he would China, but like he is China. And so I think they're asking for, you know, some talks versus we don't like this direction of how you're treating us.
Yeah. And the other part of this is by pulling out of the Iran deal, do we start sanctioning them for dealing with Iran?
Well, you hit the jackpot. Nobody has raised this enough. Yeah, what do we do? Do they violate our sanctions? And then we, what were we going to sanction Germany, England, France? Really?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the big, that's a big part of the question.
Right.
It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Bob,
we'll
I appreciate the time, man.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff.
Okay, thank you.
As always, our good friend Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show. Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Yeah, 13%. I'm stuck on that. 13% of us think Donald Trump is trustworthy and honest. 13%. Where are those 13%? Must be like the guy that I've been going back and forth with on the Twitters who works for the Postal Service who thinks he got everything because he's wonderful and the union did nothing and the union's horrible. oh, my goodness. Oh, man, what a day. Anyway, also from the SurveyMonkey tracking poll, the 13%, yeah. Evidently, 35% of folks believe Trump has the ability to get things done. 33% say he's tough enough to get the job done. And 41% say that he stands up for what he believes. And I got to be honest, I don't know how you come to any of those. Given what we've seen over the last couple of months, the idea of standing up for what he believes in. Did we miss the whole ZTE about face? I'm expecting the tariff about face. The only thing I think he really, truly believes is he really wants a wall. And not because he cares about immigration, but because big, beautiful wall, a monument to him. That's my thought on it. I mean, it's sad, but it is what it is. And I know Rudy Giuliani's running around saying he can't be indicted. And I find it interesting that Giuliani is saying that Mueller's team told him that they can't indict him. I don't believe that for a second. But interestingly enough, Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, he said yesterday that President Trump could be indicted after he leaves office. I mean, that could happen. He's not above the law. It could happen, and it could also happen, as Blumenthal says, you know, if they go through the courts and it's upheld. You know, I want to remind everybody, you know, Bill Clinton was almost impeached over a land deal that they lost money on. Everybody remember Whitewater? You know, just for a second, they lost money on that deal, which then morphed into the Monica Lewinsky and all of the shenanigans and all of the stuff with Ken Starr. But they lost a ton of money on that deal. Stop and think about this deal that's going on right now in China. China, China, China. I mean, Indonesia, that with Chinese money. $500 million. You don't think that's a sweetener to get on his good side? Come on. You don't think that that's something that was, look how wonderful we are to you. You don't think all of this stuff with Kushner and his father and this, the 666 building. You don't think all of this are just sweeteners to get on Trump's good side? You don't think all of the money that Michael Cohen was trying to extort from companies was all about trying to get on Trump's good side? I mean, come on. We said it from the beginning. On Inauguration Day 2017, I said, you are going to be amazed
at how this administration robs us blind. The kleptocracy will be amazing. The robbers of the past, the Bonnie and Clydes, the Pretty Boy Floyds, the Derringers, all of them, the Dillingers, all of them are going to be in awe at how this administration robbed from the poor and gave to the rich. It's going to be amazing. And I'm telling you, we're the ones getting fleeced. It just is what it is. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.